Morning. I said this in the first service. It's actually a great morning. I feel like with what we've already had, I could just sit here and pray and end the service, and my cup's already full. It's been an amazing, incredible morning already. Again, for those of you who don't know me, my name is Garrett Merzberger. I'm an elder here in this church, and somewhat recently I had what some might call a midlife crisis, except unlike most middle-aged men, I didn't go out and buy myself a sports car. Instead, I decided to go to school to become a pastor. So a little bit different of a road than buying a sports car, but God has really, it's only been 3 months so far that I've been back in school, but God is just doing some incredible things in my life, and I'm so thankful that he put me on this journey. Now, I know what some of you might be thinking. Some of you might be thinking, oh, sweet, a rookie preacher, I can tune him out for the next 20, 25 minutes and think about what I have to do today, think about the chores or what I'm going to do this week. But before you do that, it's actually been 6 months since I last preached. I preached my first sermon out in the pavilion, and that was a great experience. It's been 6 months since I preached, so before you check out on me, think of it this way. Think about this kid's had 6 months to prepare for this sermon this morning. Most pastors have 6 days. I've had 6 months, so this is going to be good. That's the pressure I want this morning. And if that's what keeps you engaged, then please do so. I want to challenge you to think about this morning. Have this holy expectancy, this anticipation that God is showing up this morning. In fact, I want to pray about that right now before we jump into the service, all right? So if you'd pray with me. God, I thank you for this morning. I thank you for Plymouth Alliance Church. I'm thankful that you are here this morning. I'd ask that you would just clear our minds, Lord. May the stresses of this past week or this upcoming week just melt away, Father. Your burden is light. Take our burden and carry it, and may we focus nothing other than focusing on you this morning. Father, may we hear directly from you. Open our hearts, open our eyes from the youngest to the oldest here this morning. May we be engaged, and may we have this divine expectancy that we are going to hear from you in your name. Amen. Before I jump into the sermon, I wanted to give you a little update of what's been going on in Elkhart Lake. I know we just gave an update, my wife and I, 4 weeks ago, but that's how cool God is. He's been doing stuff just in the last 4 weeks. My wife continues to lead a woman's Bible study and a high school girls' Bible study, and let me tell you, those numbers are growing. And not only are they growing, but these women and these girls, they're coming to Bible study with excitement, with that anticipation I was just talking about. When you see someone who's just hearing the word for the first time or really kind of applying it, you see the switch go off, and it's so cool to see that fire get ignited. And that's what we're seeing with the women and the girls in Elkhart. Lord willing, we're still hoping to launch a boys' Bible study the last Friday in March, and so we're going to be getting the word out to the high school boys here soon, and we're targeting that last Friday in March for that. And just this past week, my wife said something incredible to me. She said, one of the women that she prays with on a weekly basis, one of the women in her Bible study, really one of the women who's really kind of newer in her faith, she has been praying and she feels this conviction, this calling from the Lord to start a middle school girls' Bible study. It's so awesome what God is doing in Elkhart Lake. If you would have told me 5 years ago that in this spring we'd have 4 different Bible studies reaching almost 100 different people in Elkhart, I would have laughed at you. And yet God continues to move in front of us. He continues to kick down doors. And all we're doing is following. It has nothing to do with what we're doing as a family. It is God going ahead and opening those doors. And it has been incredible to see. And my friends, if you want to be a part of this journey, Plymouth Alliance is a part of this journey. They're the ones helping birth this church plant, if you will. And we are still looking for people. We're looking for prayer warriors still. Our goal is to get to 100 prayer warriors. We're at about 50 right now. And a prayer warrior is just someone who prays for us in Elkhart, prays that God rises up other leaders in Elkhart. And just pray for Elkhart, that God would continue to move ahead of us and open those doors. And so we're looking for more prayer warriors. We've also had people ask how they can get involved, and we absolutely are going to be looking for volunteers. The snowball is starting to get bigger. We don't have a need necessarily today, but it's going to be coming. We will hope to plant this community center, and we're going to need boots on the ground. And so if you have a passion or desire to get involved in that, talk to us. We may not have something for you today, but we know that God's going to open those doors as well in the near future. And so if you have a desire to be a prayer partner or get involved, I'd ask you to talk to myself or to Heather after the service today and just let us know you're interested. Now, I want to try to transition us into the sermon this morning. When I spoke last, I'm sure you all remember that I preached on Joseph from the book of Genesis. If you recall, I tried to squeeze 13 chapters into one sermon. That was my first sermon, and I think I did an okay job, but it was a lot to try to cram into one service. And so when Pete asked me to continue this series of being immovable, he said, I'd like you to speak on Job, the book of Job. And I remember thinking, and actually I think I asked him after what service one day, I said, is anybody else speaking on Job, or is it just me? And he said, no, it's just you. Well, last time I checked, Job has 42 chapters, not 13, 42 chapters. And I kind of can picture Pete in his office laughing, saying, look, this is some rookie preacher hazing, like, we got him. Because the last time I checked, Pete, you know, he preaches like two or three verses at a time. And Job, I counted, has 1,070 verses. But don't worry, we're not going to go over all 1,070 verses today. I'm going to primarily focus on the beginning of Job and the end of Job. And what happens in the middle is still this beautiful thing. It's this written actually almost in poetry form. But it's essentially Job's friends giving him bad advice and he going back and forth with them. And so I'd still challenge you to read that if you haven't read it. But we're going to, for this morning's sake, primarily focus on the beginning of Job and the end of Job. So before I get into reading the passage for this morning, I want to set a little bit of background, some information, because I think this is helpful. The book of Job, many scholars believe, is one of the oldest written books of the Bible. You see, Job is believed to live around 2000 BC, a little over 4,000 years ago. We know he's old because in the book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel himself in chapter 14, verse 14, references Job as a historical figure. So we don't know when the book of Job was written, but we know it's old. We also don't know who wrote the book of Job. Many scholars have three different thoughts. They think first it was Job. After all, he did live 140 years. He had plenty of time to write the book. It's also filled with so many intricate details that people say it had to be Job. But we don't know for sure. Some say it was Elihu. Elihu is the fourth friend that gets referenced in Job. It gets later, much later in the book of Job, but he's the youngest of the four. And some say it was him. He was an eyewitness, and it had to be an eyewitness who recorded all this in the book of Job. And lastly, some people think it was Moses. You see, Moses lived in Midian, if you recall, for 40 years, and that is adjacent to the land of Uz or Uz, where Job lived, and people believe Moses found a scroll or some sort of written parchment that he then wrote the book of Job. But ultimately, we don't know who wrote it. To make this book a little bit even more interesting or more peculiar, I might say, is that it takes place in the land of Uz, or Uz, as I said, which is Asia, or today northern day Arabia. Job himself is not an Israelite, even though most of the stories in the Old Testament are about Israelites. And his four friends aren't Israelites. The last peculiar thing about the book of Job, I think, is that we see that Job go through utter devastation, utter tragedy, and yet we never get the why. Why did God allow that to happen to Job? So if I quickly recap, we don't know when the book of Job was written. We don't know who wrote the book of Job. We don't know why it's about a land called Uz, not in Israel, why it's about non-Israelites, and why it doesn't answer the question of why. But maybe, just maybe that's the way it's supposed to be. Maybe God doesn't want us to worry about all that. Maybe he would rather have us simply focus on God himself. After all, if you read Job, if any of you have read it, and if you haven't, I challenge you to go read it, but the end of Job, near the end, there's this incredible scene. And it goes a little something kind of like this. I paraphrase a little bit, but it says, God, he is the God of the universe. He's the GOAT, the greatest of all time, smarter, stronger, more wise, more loving, more knowledgeable than any human being on the planet. He's the one who laid the earth's foundation. He's the one who marked off its dimension. He's the one who can bring forth constellations. He's the one who controls lightning bolts on command. He's the one who can catch the scent of battle from afar. My friends, he is God. Why would we ever question anything he does? Why would we ever not put our faith and our trust in him? And that's what I think the book of Job is about. How can we, like Job, have immovable faith and immovable trust in him no matter the circumstances, without getting the why? For our scripture reading this morning, we're going to turn to Job 1, in your pew Bibles or your chair Bibles here, it's on page 350. Job, if you have your own Bible, if you turn to the very middle of the Bible, you'll get to Psalms. Turn back one chapter and you'll get to Job. We're going to read Job 1. I know it's kind of long, so bear with me. But if you haven't read the story, I think it's important that we lay this ground or this foundation here of what happened to Job. So please join me in reading here. I'm going to look at Job 1 and I'm going to read it all. In the land of Uz, there lived a man named Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among the people of the East. His sons used to hold feasts in their homes on their birthdays, and they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would make arrangements for them to be purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, "Perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." This was Job's regular custom. One day the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming throughout the earth, going back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied. "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But now stretch out your hands and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then. Everything he has is in your power, but on the man himself do not lay a finger." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. One day when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabians attacked and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I'm the only one who's escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The Chaldeans formed 3 raiding parties and swept down on your camels and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, "Your sons and your daughters, they were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house when suddenly a mighty wind, 4 corners of the house, it collapsed on them and they are dead. And I am the only." At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. He fell on the ground in worship. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb and naked I will depart. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. My sermon on, I really don't feel like the story of Job is actually about those 3 questions. In fact, the book of Job, as I said earlier in my intro, never even answers those questions. Instead, I think the book immovable starts out with how blessed Job was. We see he had everything. As we just read, he was the greatest man among the people of the East. So he was famous. He had a lot of money. But it says even more. It specifically says in verse 1 that Job was blameless, upright, and that he feared God. In fact, a few verses later, we see this incredible scene that we don't see too often in the Bible. Did you catch it? You guys, we have a direct front row seat, VIP only access into the throne room of God. Picture this. The angels start coming into the throne room and get gathered. God himself is there sitting on his throne on high, and in slithers Satan into the room. Soon there's this lengthy dialogue between God and Satan. In fact, it's the longest recorded dialogue between God and Satan in all the Bible. Time out. Isn't this book incredible? If you don't think so, then I don't think you're reading it. And when I say read it, I mean read it. Dive into it. Study it. We just saw a scene into the throne room of God. Name me another book that can picture and draw this picture of the throne room of God. This book is incredible. If you're not reading it, get into it. This is such an awesome scene. And in case you miss it, I just love how God himself describes Job to Satan. What does he say? He uses the exact same 3 words as it did in verse 1. It says that he is blameless, upright and that he fears God. That's how he describes Job to Satan. When I read this, I paused and I thought to myself, if God was talking to Satan today about me, how would he describe me? Would he use any of those words? I want you to think about that. Think about that this week. If God was describing you to Satan, how would he describe you? If you don't know how to answer that question, let me ask you, what have you done recently? What did you do yesterday for God's name, for God's glory, for God's... Well, maybe you're thinking, oh, yeah, I mean, yes, yesterday was sad. I was off. I had stuff to do. Okay. What did you do last week? Or last month? Or last... When you experienced something unexpected, some horrible tragedy in your life, how did you respond to God? Did you respond in faith? Did you respond with worship? With trust? If you want God to describe you like Job, then you have to spend time with him. Spend time in his word. Love what he loves. Hate what he hates. To be blameless... I love this. In Psalm 119, it's described as those who walk according to the law of the Lord. How can you walk in the law of the Lord without knowing the law of the Lord? You've got to spend some time. Make time in your daily schedule, even if it's just 5 minutes. It was last week or the week before, we as a congregation took a survey of how often are we reading our Bibles in a week? And let me tell you, I don't think the results were very good. I know myself, when I get busy, when I have a lot on my plate, what's the first thing I typically cut? I'll cut my morning devotions. Why? That's the last thing I should be cutting. We need to be spending time in his word. All right, sorry, I got off track there. Back to the story here. Before we see how Job responds to this horrific tragedy that's about to come, before we see how he actually responds, I don't want us to miss something here. Something that happens in the throne room of God. On Job. This is important for us to remember that Satan, he has no power, no authority over God. I'll say that again. Satan has no power or authority over God. He is almighty. So now we start to see how this unfolds. In verses 13 to 19, with God's permission, we see Satan just struck utter devastation on Job. And I mean utter devastation. His children are killed. His livestock are stolen. His buildings destroyed. His servants are put to the sword. I cannot imagine the pain of just one of these things happening, much less all of them happening on the same day. And yet through it all, how did Job respond? Did you catch that in verses 20 to 22? See what he does and what he says. Job's first response was to what? To worship God. I don't know about you, but that probably wouldn't have been my first response. And I just love what he says, these next two or three lines. It's some of the most beautiful written lines in the Bible. He said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." Here's a man, he just lost everything. You see, Job had a movable, unshakable faith in his God. I love this quote from Pastor Rick Warren. He said, and I quote, "When you fully comprehend that there is more to life than just here and now, and you realize that this life is just preparation for eternity, you will begin to live differently. You will start living in light of eternity, and that will color how you handle every relationship, every task, every circumstance. Suddenly, many activities and goals, and even problems that seem so important, will appear trivial and petty and unworthy of your attention. The closer you live to God, the smaller everything else appears," end quote. Job understood this. I don't want to diminish the pain and the devastation and the sadness and the sorrow that Job must have been going through, but he was so close to God. He was a man of faith, a man living with eternity in mind. And I can tell you that most people today, in fact, most Christians aren't living with eternity in mind. When you understand and have the right perspective on where everything comes from, It's a whole lot easier when it's all taken away. Let me say that one more time. When you understand and have the right perspective on where everything comes from, it's a whole lot easier when it's all taken away. It's not ours. It's God's. I love how Teresa, where she right there, she described her home, and she basically said, I'm just living here. She owns the home, but really she's saying God owns the home. She knows that it's from God. Your faithfulness shouldn't change just because your circumstances do. Too often, we change our faithfulness based on our circumstances. So our question after reading the book of Job today shouldn't be on why does God allow this to happen. Instead, the focus should be on Job's response. He had incredible, immovable faith. We need to live with that same immovable faith that God is in control of all things. And one day, we will live with Him in eternity. Hebrews 11 is all about faith. I love what it says in Hebrews 11, verse 6. It says, without faith, it is impossible to please God. Now, it doesn't say, when things are going good, and then you please God. No, it's without faith. No matter the circumstances, we have to have that faith. C.S. Lewis once said, and I quote again, in the end, there are only two kinds of people in the world. Those who say to God, Thy will be done. And those who, in the end, God says to them, Thy will be done. Tragically, many people in this world are going to have to endure eternity without God because they walk through this world saying, My will be done. Job was a man who said, Thy will be done. Like the old hymn that we just sang, Job knew the words of whatever my lot thou hast taught me to say, it is well with my soul. We too need to respond that way, no matter what we're going through. Have that immovable faith. Trust that God will show up, and it will be well with our souls. This brings me to my second point, that Job also had immovable trust. Now you might be asking yourself, what's the difference between faith and trust? Well, up until this point, if you've read this book, you know that Job, he hasn't spoken directly to God. Therefore, what he's been living on has been faith. As we know, again, the faith chapter, Hebrews 11, very first verse says, faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance of what we do not see, or in this case for Job, hear. He hadn't heard from God. Trust, on the other hand, is based more on evidence. That's the difference. Throughout his entire trial and over the next 36 chapters of Job, Job never understands why he is suffering. There is no explanation from God. Not one sign, not one word, nothing to increase his faith. Job is forced to persevere with no answers, and his faith is stretched to the very limits. Not only does he have no answers, but his three supposed friends for those 36 chapters, he's going back and forth with them, wrestling. Even his wife tells him to just basically roll over, curse God, and die. Now, I'm sure everyone in this room has experienced some sort of tragedy in their life. Maybe you're going through really a valley right now. I know for myself, as I kind of joked at the beginning, I'm going through a midlife crisis, but about 2 years ago, I lost my job. And now you might think, I've lost my job before. It's hard, but come on. Well, for me, it just crushed me because I didn't just lose my job. I lost my career. Something I had worked for 20 years, climbing that corporate ladder, and I was proud of where I was. And I lost my job over a rumor, over a lie. And I remember getting down on my knees, and I didn't worship God. What did I do? Instead, I said, God, why? Why did you let this happen? How could you let this happen? What am I going to do? How am I going to provide for my family? And I think God knew that I was probably weak in my faith at the time, so he actually answered me that why. He basically showed me that I was running as fast as I could in this direction. I was going on the path of my will be done. And he hit me upside the head and he said, Son, we need to go this way. We're going to walk, and I'm going to walk with you. It's got to be thy will be done. And I am so thankful that he brought me to that low point, that he crushed me, because I'd still be running that way thinking I was doing a good job. I got the why answered. But for Job, he never gets the why answered. Instead, he gets these horrible responses from his wife and his so-called friends. We see Job wrestle with them. But then, you guys, we see something incredible happen in chapter 38. Guess what happens? God shows up. I say it that way because if you've read chapter 38, he doesn't just show up. He shows up. He sets the tone when he shows up. He sets the tone with his very first question that I think would make even the world's greatest attorneys fill their pants. I mean, he just brings it. Look at chapter 38, verse 4. He says to Job, "Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand." And for the next two, almost three chapters, God asks Job some of the most spectacular creation questions imaginable. And in Job 40, verse 4, Job finally responds. Very smartly, I might add, he says, "I am unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth." Now, I think Job, who already responded to this incredible tragedy upon his family, I think he's handled it better than probably any man could have. And then he responds to God this way. I think he responds very smartly. You see, Job understands that God knows better than him, that God is all-knowing, God is omnipotent, he's able to do anything, and God is eternal. And that's where his trust is lying. It's not in himself. Job realizes that faithfulness is trusting God, not yourself. My friends, when faithfulness breaks, when trust breaks, it has nothing to do with God. Nothing. He hasn't abandoned you. In fact, it's the opposite. You've abandoned him. You're trying to trust yourself rather than God. You're trying to save yourself. You're trying to do the my will be done. But that faithfulness, it always starts with our trust in God. Whenever we doubt, whenever we go through something tragic or hard and we know we just want the why, I challenge you to read Job 38 to 40 because you'll quickly see that he is God. And he can handle anything because he is the one who made everything. He's the one who sees everything. He's the one who knows everything. And he's the one who sent his one and only son for me. The guy who was running down his own path. He sent his son for me, for you. As we just sang, though Satan should buffet, though trials should come, trials are going to come, you guys. If they haven't, they will. Let this blessed assurance control that Christ has regarded my helpless estate and has shed his own blood for my soul. Amen to that. Job gets this. You see in Job 42, verse 2, he again responds to God by saying, "I know that you can do all things. No plan of yours can be thwarted." Guys, what God puts into motion, no one can stop. No one. And if we trust and we put our faith in him, he will reward the faithful. We see at the end of Job, what did he do? If you compare Job 1 to the end of Job, he blessed Job with twice as much. You can count him. Look at how many cattle. He gave him twice as much. My friends, for those today who have faith and trust in him, there is a reward waiting for us that's so much better than twice as much that we have. There's a day when he is going to return. He's going to rule on high forever. And Lord, haste the day when the faith shall be sight, the clouds will be rolled back as a scroll, the trump shall resound, and the Lord shall descend. Even so, it is well with my soul. Job had immovable trust, and it was well with his soul, despite everything that happened, despite not receiving the why. He had immovable trust in his God. As I close this sermon, I want to read a quick story of a man who, like Job, lost everything. In October 1871, the Great Chicago Fire brought the city of Chicago to ashes, along with the financial state of one prominent lawyer, Horatio Spafford. Desiring a respite for his devastated family, he sent his wife and his four young children on a ship for a holiday in Europe, or a vacation in Europe, where he would join them later. His family's ship, however, would not make it to Europe. While crossing the Atlantic, the steamship was struck by a passing iron vessel, and 226 passengers lost their lives, including his 11-year-old Tanetta, 9-year-old Bessie, 5-year-old Margaret Lee, and 2-year-old Annie. Only his wife survived, sending him a telegram from England with the simple words, "Saved alone." Horatio Spafford took the journey across the Atlantic to meet his wife in England. It was on this journey, over the same waters that drowned and swallowed his four precious children, that he penned the original lyrics, "When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, it is well with my soul." My friend Spafford, like Job, knew pain. But they had immovable trust and faith in God. They both lived out what Paul wrote in Philippians 4:11-13, which says, "I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content. I know how to be brought low and I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me." In the midst of our suffering, we must not abandon God, because he will never abandon us. You want to live upright, blameless, fearing God? It starts by fixing your eyes on Jesus. Have a movable faith. Have a movable trust. Until when? Until the clouds be rolled back as a scroll. The trump shall resound and the Lord shall descend. Even so, it is well with my soul. Let's pray. God, I am so thankful that you are God. You are all-knowing, all-powerful. And I'm thankful that no matter what our circumstances, no matter what we're going through, no matter what valley, no matter if we don't get the why, I'm thankful that we know you will show up. You will provide yourself. I'm so thankful for that, Lord. Help us to remember, like Job, like Horatio, to have immovable faith and immovable trust in you. In your name, amen.